Welcome to the after party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturdays. So hey guys, Anna David with the After Party Pod. Podcast all about addiction and recovery and all those other things, which hopefully you know because you downloaded this. If you're new to the show, I'm so glad you're here. I am getting new listeners lately because the numbers have grown, and I'm going to credit you guys who have been telling your friends about this podcast and also these great guests that I've been getting. So first thing I want to tell you is that today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial by going to audibletrial.com/afterpartypod. Audible is super, super awesome. I just actually talked to them because I'm going to be recording one of my Kindle singles. One of them is already available, called Animal Attraction, but I'm going to be recording my second one. And so I'm going to say, go and get that, but don't go and get that because that's not available yet. And besides, that's a Kindle single and it costs less money. And if you want the most bang for your buck, you should get like a 60-hour book or whatever. And there's a lot of great books on there. Have you read The Night of the Gun by David Carr? Awesome addiction book. He talks about using drugs with Tom Arnold. That's not at all the most interesting thing in there. The interesting thing is that he goes back and he interviews all the people that are involved in the anecdotes that he tells himself and others about his years using, and he finds out how absolutely differently he remembers them from how they actually took place. Fascinating book. He's an amazing writer. So go get that or whatever else you want, again, by going to audibletrial.com/afterpartypod. You are helping this show if you do that. You're also helping the show if you go and give it a 5-star review on the old iTunes and subscribe. I can't tell you what a difference it makes. I do these shows hoping that as many people as possible can hear them, and that is the best way for people to do that. I appreciate your emails, by the way. I've been getting some of the loveliest emails imaginable from you guys and hearing that you're liking the sound quality. So that is all good. Have a great guest for you today. But before we get into that, what do I want to say? I want to tell you guys how I am, and that is well. I took a week off, which is for a self-claimed and also diagnosed by everyone who knows me workaholic, was a really big deal because I do take quote-unquote vacations, but I basically, what I mean by that is that I work from a different place, whether that is Hawaii or Ojai or wherever, New York. That's what I mean. And I had really kind of hit a wall where I realized I had to stop. And I did. And here's something interesting. I had to work really hard to take that vacation because it's like I don't really have one of those jobs where you can just sort of take a week off and just pick it back up again, because I run this website, After Party Chat, I hope you read it, where we put, you know, we have a certain number of posts every day, and I'm responsible for editing all of them, so I kind of had to work like a crazy person in order to get it ready for me to go, and so I was tired. But here's the interesting thing. I did nothing. I went with my mom to Big Sur and Pebble Beach, which was lovely, and such a nice place. In Big Sur, I couldn't get cell reception or Wi-Fi. I'm not gonna lie, I did panic a little bit. I was excited to get it back. I actually, if you are such a faithful listener of this podcast that you noticed, I wasn't able to post the Alonzo Bodden podcast when I normally do, which, I mean, probably only worried me, but it was fine. I literally almost posted it from the road while driving Highway 1, which is not recommended because it's very windy. But here's the interesting thing I learned, and I don't know if you guys are sort of, you know, keep yourselves overly busy like I do, because it is almost an addiction. You know, it's just a way to sort of not have to, you know, possibly feel bad. But I did nothing. I did nothing. I left on a Monday. I did nothing the weekend before. I slept. I read. I meditated. Probably took a couple showers. Not even sure about that. Then I went to Pebble Beach at Big Sur, as mentioned, where I continued to do nothing. I just did it with my mom. We went shopping. We went to a spa. We hung out. We went to this really cool place. It's called the Henry Miller Memorial Library, right on the, you know, on the road near Nepenthe. If you guys know that place, it's a beautiful restaurant out in Big Sur. And it's not a bookstore. I mean, it's not a library. It's a bookstore, and it was Henry Miller's best friend, and he decided when he died he was going to leave this house to be, you know, an ode to Henry Miller, and it's really cool. I mean, they only sell like 9 books besides Henry Miller books, but my mom and I hung out there, and that was great. And so my point is this, then I came back on a Friday thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be raring to go. I've been cooped up doing nothing. I just did nothing over the weekend. Nothing. I went to a farmer's market, went to a meeting, worked out, hung out. And I was thinking, as I was doing nothing yesterday and I was still really tired, maybe this like unplugging and taking time off thing is overrated, because all it's doing is making me more tired. And will I never, you know, get it back? And then I woke up this morning and I feel completely different about work. Whatever. This is what everyone else, you guys know this, like completely re-energized, completely raring to go, like everything's under control as opposed to, you know, I'm swimming and drowning. So I guess this was going to be an intro focused on what's the point of unplugging, and instead it's become an intro focused on try unplugging. You heard it here, not first, not second, but, you know, 1,000,000th. Anyway, moving on to today's guest. He's such a sweetheart. His name is Caleb Bacon. You may know him because he has a very successful podcast called The Man Show. He's also a staff writer on Sullivan and Son. And he is sober over 6 years, I believe almost 7, maybe over 7. He talks about it in the interview. And I've known him for about, I want to say I met him when he was a year sober. And he was writing for LAist and a couple other places, and really newly sober and trying to bring a lot of awareness to addiction and recovery. And I admire that a lot. And he's just a genuinely good guy. He talks in this interview about being so angry that he punches a bus stop. That's a spoiler alert, but not really. And it's impossible to picture. He's very tall. He's kind of got that gentle giant quality to him. And this was just a really good conversation. We were very mellow. We were very relaxed. I possibly credit my relaxation to this rejuvenating vacation I just told you about. And I think you guys are going to like it. So here you go, Caleb Bacon.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God. I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as right. I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky, because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
Oh my God. So yeah. Whoa, Caleb. Was that the longest kind of pre-interview experience you've ever had?
I felt like that was a job interview of for me being the after-party chat sound tech.
Listeners, know that Caleb Bacon is not only a charming man that you're about to learn, you're going to learn this, but what the fuck? We just went through sound problems, not sound problems, I want to clarify, potential sound improvements that may have caused a double meltdown.
Sure.
A single meltdown for sure.
Like, I've grown a full beard since I first got here.
I had 3 birthdays since you got here.
I didn't get you 3 presents.
I know, 3 birthdays and 3 sober birthdays. 6 presents, I would say.
One day at a time.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, we're here. It feels like a journey, much like sobriety. It's a good metaphor, right? Hi, Caleb.
Hey, Anna. I'm great
pretending
to see you.
Yeah, I'm pretending we didn't just spend an hour
I just walked
together.
In. Well, you are using the digital audio recorder that I suggested.
No, but technically, I don't think... Okay, because I know that Paul Gilmartin suggested one, And then it was too confusing for me, and so then, yes, you suggested this.
Yeah.
And I went and did it.
Yeah.
Is that you ringing?
No.
You would never be so unprofessional. I mean, you know more about sound, according to what I just experienced, more than anyone I've ever met.
I know, like, the bare minimum to do, like, a decent sounding podcast, but...
Listeners, go listen to his podcast. I'm assuming it's gloriously perfect. Okay, because you have had your podcast... For how long now?
Well, I had another podcast before that.
The Gentleman's Club.
Yeah, yes. And then I did college radio before that.
Okay, let's go all the way back.
Okay.
I'm going to pretend that I know nothing.
Okay.
Where did you go to college?
State University of New York at Albany.
Okay.
So.
Because you grew up there.
That's where I grew up.
Nice.
And I screwed around in high school, and my parents were just like, we're not going to pay a lot of money for you to go screw around at some college.
They knew you were screwing around?
Well, I had bad grades.
How bad is bad?
Well, I was like the classic underachiever.
Yes.
It was like teachers would always call my parents and say, he's a bright kid, he's smart when he applies himself, but he just doesn't give a crap.
Right.
And so like I had like an 80 average.
That's not a bad student.
I think it was bad for me, because when I applied myself, they're like, oh, this is a different kid.
See, that's so... Okay, this is why I find this interesting. I was just telling somebody this. My perception and the standards I hold myself to are so ludicrous, and I do think this is alcoholic. Because basically, I'll be like, I was a horrible student. I went to a horrible college, and people ask... And they go, God, where did you go to school? And I'm like, Trinity College. And they go, that's a great school. And in my brain, it's horrific, and my B's were horrifying. And part of that was my family standards, but part of it is just the way... I believe alcoholics see things as we're just our expectations of ourselves and other people are so high.
Sure.
Because I don't think 80 is, I think that most would say, wow, that's a pretty good student.
I had an 80 average, but like a 0% effort.
Okay, because I was making a lot of effort myself, they were just ineffective efforts. You were consciously not making an effort.
Right. Yeah, that was all.
Because you were bored?
There's those, like, logical reasons of, yes, like, school is kind of boring.
Yeah.
But then it's also, I didn't care. Like, I didn't have an interest in applying myself. There was never a class where I'm like, oh, this is a fun subject that I would like to learn more in my own time. Like, teacher, recommend me a book. Like,
what were you interested in then?
I like computers.
Uh-huh.
I like weightlifting. I like drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I like music.
Mm-hmm.
Like that was, like, and none of that was in school.
Right. I mean, music.
I'd like to listen to Beastie Boys.
Right, they weren't teaching you about...
The Beastie Boys did not teach me. No.
Okay, and so, interesting. So, I was just talking to somebody about this also. Don't you wish that they had said in school, here are the things you're going to really wish later that, you know, geometry, don't even worry about it. You know, chemistry, not important. History, yes, pay attention here. English, pay attention, but don't worry about these stupid papers you're writing, because that is the opposite of what you're going to do later if you want to be a writer.
Well, I wish I did that with Spanish, because I moved to California, and right. It's like, oh man, I can order at a taco truck, but it'd be helpful to know more.
See, I studied French. I wish they had told me how useless that was going to be.
There's no taco trucks for crepes.
No. I mean, there are, but, you know, not very useful in California.
Well, what I wish, and I'm totally serious about this,
mm-hmm.
is that teachers pulled me aside. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I would have listened, but mm-hmm. like here's what I wish they said was, you know what, most of the stuff we're teaching doesn't matter. But what we're teaching you is how to work hard, how to focus on doing stuff you don't want to do, because when you get out into the workforce, you're going to have to get good at doing stuff you don't want to do, so that hopefully you can do the stuff you want to do.
Okay.
And then when you get to the stuff you want to do, you'll have like a great work ethic and know how to self-motivate to write more scripts.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would have been... I think that's useless too, because I think that A work ethic is something you develop that has nothing to do here. You have a very high work ethic. You are a very successful TV writer. You have this podcast. It's very successful. Clearly, your work ethic is impressive, and yet you are making absolutely no effort. So it doesn't. I don't think it applies. I don't mean to be argumentative for the sake of being argumentative.
No, I know. And thank you for calling me very successful. But
you are!
Yeah, I'm doing like the thing I want to do, getting paid, and
yeah.
I live in an apartment with a pool.
Yeah!
Because I'm not dirty.
Right, that's a dream come true.
It is, yeah.
It is in the valley, but...
I love it. But it's
even
not,
that's part of the dream.
It's not the deep valley.
No.
It's close to here.
True. So, okay, so there you were in New York. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a younger brother.
You have a younger brother. Yeah. And you were not applying yourself, and you were interested in drinking. When did you first drink?
My first real drunk was in 8th grade.
Okay.
It was beautiful.
Was it from the parents' liquor cabinet?
My parents are not alcoholics,
mm-hmm.
and they're, you know, as we say, normies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they, it's not like, sure, they didn't drink, but Dad was always smoking a joint. Like, it was just nothing like that.
Right.
Like, they'd have a few drinks here and there, not really into it. But I think it's like a white people thing that...
Are they black?
No, my parents are white. And so, like, I don't know, it seems like all these white people always get each other alcohol, for Christmas.
They do?
Yeah. And then, I don't know where I'm from.
Okay. They give, like, bottles of scotch?
Yeah, I don't know why I say that's a white people thing.
I don't even know if it's a thing. I don't know if it was. Okay, go on.
All right. So,
go on.
So I
poking holes in everything you've said.
I sound racist already, and I'm like, that's not what I was
I'm
going to
joke about your parents being black, so.
That's true. Yeah, they're
Caleb is very white.
I could have two black adopted parents that
it's
I adopted.
It's true. I know some black Jews that are adopted.
Yeah?
Okay, good. We're both racist. Go on.
Okay, we're so, tied.
Okay.
And so my parents had this like big liquor cabinet mm-hmm. that had like all these dusty bottles
right.
in it with alcohol.
Right.
And those were like the last dusty alcohol bottles I would ever see.
Right.
So I remember getting like this empty Gatorade bottle, like sneaking in there.
Yeah.
Putting like, they won't notice a little glug of this, a little glug of that.
Yeah.
I made this like Gatorade container of like the grossest
of course.
Mixed drink of all time. And I went to this party at a kid in my neighborhood's house and his parents were gone. And I get to the door, he's like, hey, you gotta pay for beer if you're drinking. I'm like, no, I brought my own drink.
Right.
And I pull out this like yellow gross Gatorade and he's like, oh, you got a tornado. I was like, yeah, I got a tornado. I didn't even know what that was.
What
like,
a savvy kid this was.
Yeah, no, this kid.
Is he in the rooms? I hope.
I don't know. Okay. I don't know. I haven't kept track with him, of him. And so I got shit-faced off of this disgusting substance.
Puking is involved in this night.
I didn't puke, actually.
It's amazing.
I had a... My constitution would get a lot weaker,
mm-hmm.
and my drinking wrecked my stomach.
What does that mean?
I later found out in sobriety that I had a food allergy to some of the main ingredients in beer.
Oh, wow.
So I was... I don't want to get gross, but...
Okay, so gross things happened all the time?
My stomach was not happy with
Were you... but like when you got sober, did the doctor say, oh my God, this the tissue in your stomach or whatever?
The doctor basically said... I said, hey, my stomach's not a problem anymore. He's like, all right, don't drink. You'll be fine.
Right, okay.
It was kind of that simple.
Did you go to the doctor for stomach issues while you were drinking?
No.
Okay.
No, because, my answer for that was, to just drink more and not worry about it.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Health solutions, pre-sobriety.
That first drunk was just so much fun. It was like this adventure.
But here's what's interesting. You did this on your own. Very few people talk about that. I think a lot of people say, my friend and I were in front of my parents' liquor cabinet. Do you know what I mean? You came up with this all on your own.
Yeah. I don't know why. Like, I always had this thing in my head. Maybe it was TV, films. But I knew alcohol was going to be awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And, I couldn't wait.
Right.
And, I had a sip of my dad's beer here and there. But I was just waiting for the time where I didn't have to be around my family. And I could be a 13-year-old kid, out just getting plowed.
Why did you want to be away from your family?
Because I would get in trouble if I was drunk around them.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, no, my family life was pretty good
right.
growing up.
Right, the Bacons are good people.
Yeah, they are good people.
So, okay, so you have this night lying about your drink, having the best time ever, correct?
Yeah, and didn't get caught.
And how did you feel?
Well, for me, what I noticed about it was, it was like I got to have, like, my own little movie. Mm-hmm. Like, going to this party, and they were thinking I was cool because I brought my own gross concoction.
Mm-hmm.
We, like, heard something outside, and someone's like, oh, the cops are here. And we're, like, in eighth grade, and it was probably, like, 9:30 at night.
Right.
And there were no cops.
Right.
And so me and a friend were, like, running around my neighborhood and just kind of walking, like, our drunk off a little bit before I had to go home, and his mom picked him up from my place.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, like, goodnight to my parents, and as I was saying goodnight to my parents, my friend was in the bathroom that had an adjoining wall to their room.
Mm-hmm.
As he was peeing, he fell back into the tub.
Mm-hmm.
And we still didn't get in trouble. And it was like the loudest thud. And I was like, oh, he's just a silly goose.
Right.
And so I had this, like, great, great time.
Right.
And so suddenly, I was like, whoa, life can be way better than just hanging out watching basketball or whatever else I did.
Right. So how often did you drink after that?
I didn't pursue it like crazy, but I looked forward to getting drunk whenever I could.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was mostly on the weekends, and then I was 15, I got my first fake ID.
How'd you get it?
My friend and I made it on his computer using Microsoft Paint.
Oh my god,
yeah.
Did that actually work, that ID?
It did. And we used my sophomore yearbook picture and, like, cut it out of, like, my student ID and put it on there. And so we could go down to the hood and show, like, the liquor stores didn't really care.
Right, clearly they didn't care
something.
If they were allowing that one.
Yeah, I was, like, 6 foot tall, but I was super baby-faced.
Right. You're still baby-faced.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't buy alcohol now, but if
you
I did, I'd probably get carded.
You think?
Probably.
Yeah, you could. Because I had a fake ID, by the way, but I went way more hardcore. I bought a fake birth certificate in my name, born like 4 years earlier, went
Whoa.
To the DMV and got it. I mean, that's serious dedication.
If I had to do that, I might have.
But I didn't have to, but I was like, this will work.
Look, you went to Trinity College, you're smart, Anna, you do stuff. Thoroughly.
What's funny is I went and got it in Connecticut first because I was scared, you know, California DMV, whatever. I figured it was more mellow in Connecticut. And I remember I brought my friend. I went up, filled out the form. I was shaking. Yeah. I told my parents I was doing this because I was like, you're going to need to bail me out if I, you know. And they were like, whatever. And I filled it out. We go and we sit down. And I'm like, it worked. And then they're like, excuse me, Miss David, can you please come up here? And I'm like, it's over. Okay, slap the cuffs on me. And they're like, you can't put a P.O. box as an address. and then I walked out with it. And then later I got a California one.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do you still have it?
No, I don't even think I managed to keep it until before I was 21. I'm not great with, I was good at losing things.
Okay, you put the work in, but you just couldn't keep it.
Look, it served me for many nights that I was grateful for. So, okay, so you have this shitty fake ID. I'm sorry, I'm judging because listen to what
I
have.
It was a shitty fake ID.
Yeah.
Like, we laminated it, like,
right.
Someone's job who had a laminator.
Right, and so you were out there drinking, you drank all through high school, I'm assuming.
I did, but I had, like, another addiction back then, which was weightlifting.
Okay.
And I was like, the first of my friends to, like, get tall and big and pubescent, but I was not coordinated.
Mm-hmm.
So playing team sports, and I didn't have like a killer edge to knock some fool out on the football field.
Right.
But I was good at, like, training for the sports I played.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I was, like, getting into weightlifting, I was like, I like this better than football and basketball. So how would I just do that? So I became, like, I got so into it, became, like, the strongest kid in my school, and I was, not to brag, but it got to where there were some times where I wouldn't drink for a while because of how I was training.
Wow.
But then there was other times where it was, like, every weekend or sometimes after school.
And so you were doing this, like, every day, the weight training? And do you think it was an addiction?
Yeah, yeah. I got, before I finished high school, I had 3 personal training certifications.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I wasn't a trainer, but I got so into learning about all
right.
of it. So, and that was also one of the things with my grades. Like, I got to say to my parents, like, hey, you see I'm smart and I'm doing some cool stuff. And I like, wrote some articles as, like, a high school student for, like, muscle magazines.
Okay, I'm just going to argue with one argument you used against your parents, which is that who says trainers are smart? I guess if they're doing it in high school.
If they're in high school. Okay. Yeah, that's all.
I mean, I've just met some not terribly brilliant trainers. Trainers, if you're listening, you are totally the exception, and I'm being judgmental.
Sure.
Okay, go on.
And those trainers were probably not in high school.
They were probably not in high school. I know they were not in high school. So you were doing, so were you obsessed with it? Was it dangerous? Were you tortured by it?
I was obsessed with it.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't dangerous, but I decided, because I had gotten so strong, when I was about 19 in college, I was like, I should do, like, some weightlifting competition.
Oh my God.
And, like, make it a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got injured
mm-hmm.
because of that. I got tendonitis in my arm. And then I had to, like, stop training for a while, and that was when, like, drinking picked up a
mm-hmm.
lot more, because
mm-hmm.
then it was like, okay, the weightlifting's gone, it's party time.
Right. And so you then were, there were still no consequences to your drinking at this point?
Not much. Like, I got caught smoking pot when I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
I got, like, suspended from school.
Oh, you got caught at school.
I had a pipe on me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And you can't do that.
No.
Yeah, my parents grounded me for a long time, and
mm-hmm.
but I didn't really get in trouble too much. And I was going, and I wasn't really into drugs too much,
mm-hmm.
but I did get caught leaving, like, an instant message up on, like, a computer at home, which talked about, like, snorting Ritalin.
Oh, God.
My parents weren't too happy when they saw that.
Were you prescribed Ritalin?
No.
Somebody else was.
Yeah, somebody else was.
And you had snorted it.
Yeah.
And your parents, did they even know what that meant?
Not really, but they knew it was
sketchy. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you go to college. I'm assuming screwing around in college, but yet you're doing the radio station.
Yeah, yeah. I was graduated with, like, a 2.4 GPA.
Mm, that's not good.
No, that's not good.
Yeah.
But that was... My plan was to, because my parents said, we're not going to pay a lot of money if you go to college, if you're just going to screw around. I'm like, all right, I'll show you guys.
Mm-hmm.
I'm smart. I'm going to go to the local university. I'm going to get my grades up. Then I'm going to transfer somewhere awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so my grades were good initially.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got comfortable and was like, ah, the school's fine.
Oh, okay.
So my highest GPA in college was my first semester.
Right.
And it went down every semester.
Yeah.
Incrementally. Like,
yeah.
I couldn't have tried to do that. Like, each one lower than the next.
Right, right. And were you studying English?
Communications. Yeah.
And so you... But you did say, hey, I'm going to go over to the radio station. I'm going to see what I can do there.
Yeah, I was doing stuff at the radio station, had a show, eventually ran the radio station. I was also throwing raves.
Uh-huh.
And that was all a lot of fun.
There were raves in this part of New York?
Yeah, not good ones.
Right.
Yeah.
So you would rent out a space?
Yeah.
That's very industrious.
It was, yeah. We would rent out a space, you know, get some equipment and lights and,
mm-hmm.
and DJs, and it was fun.
Okay.
It was really hard, though, because other people, like, you're going to plan raves with, usually not the most together people.
It's amazing raves ever happen at all, in a way.
It is. Yeah, absolutely.
So, okay. Yeah, I'd like to point out I was doing none of this in college. I mean, that was sort of beyond me. I don't even think they had a radio station at Trinity, you know, for all of its excellence. I don't think they had things like that. So, okay. So you graduate and you come directly here?
I went to the gal I was dating at the time had
uh-huh.
another semester
mm-hmm.
to go in school, and so she was able to do it abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do the backpack Europe thing,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not like a, I don't know, I need, like, not to be dirty
yeah.
all the time. Like,
yeah.
like the backpacking thing, I like it in, like, the romantic ideal, but I was like, how about you go to school somewhere and I'll just
hang out
go there too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so we went to Manchester, England.
Uh-huh.
And I had some friends there too. And so I got my own apartment. She lived on campus. And I, like, just partied for a whole semester.
Yeah.
And it was awesome.
Yeah, yeah, I lived in England my junior year, and that was, I mean, the pubs did close at 11, which was annoying, but Manchester's not the, I mean, it's not the sunniest place to hang out, it's not,
It was okay when I was there, though, for fall of 03.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I loved it, it was great,
mm-hmm.
great, cool experience.
Mm-hmm.
Traveled around Europe
mm-hmm.
a little bit, using that as, like, a home base, and
yeah.
I worked one day at a shoe store,
mm-hmm.
and then just never went back, like, it was... It's too much.
Right.
Got in the way of me just doing whatever I wanted to do.
It's like me with the fake ID. You could get it, but you couldn't keep it.
I gave it away.
So, okay, and so then you come back to the United States,
mm-hmm.
and you're like, I'm going to go knock them dead in Hollywood.
I worked for Red Bull in college.
Okay.
And I had a really cool job for Red Bull. And it was with, like, marketing. And so with Red Bull growing really mm-hmm. fast. There was, like, lots of cool events I got to go to all over the Northeast, and got to go to, like, business meetings and, you know, drive those funky little Red mm-hmm. Bull cars and, like, do like, adult stuff.
Yeah.
But I got to see that the guys who I worked with and who were my bosses were adults who had cool, fun jobs.
Yeah.
Who didn't have to wear suits and ties.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I want to do what they do.
Right.
Not necessarily for Red Bull, but, like, have a life where I could do something fun. And I think when you're from Albany, New York, which is a government city where a lot of people have, like, crappy government jobs where nobody really knows what anyone does.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I temped before I came out here at the Bureau, or the Department of Health Bureau of Tuberculosis Control.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what people did there.
Right.
And I think there's so many offices like that where it's just, like, paperwork.
Yeah.
And stuff. And it's so...
And watching the clock, basically.
And talking about television of the previous night.
Right. That's the water cooler thing they talk about.
Yeah. I've never seen it like that before. This was very serious.
So now they're back there talking about Sullivan and Son, maybe.
I hope so. Yeah. So we can make some more of them.
So, okay. But we're getting to that. But so you... okay. So you... they have fun at Red Bull. I want to have fun.
Yeah, and I thought of, like, okay, where are some places I could live? That would be cool. And decided it was time for good weather, good times.
Yeah.
So came out to California.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a chance to get, like, PA jobs
mm-hmm.
on TV shows. So I started doing
that. Your uncle is a producer.
Yes.
Who I met.
Oh, okay,
I was
right.
Friends with this girl briefly who was his assistant, I guess.
Yeah. At some point.
No, I think she still is.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. You know those, like, crazy AA friendships that are like, you realize, no, this is not going to happen after
sure,
all.
Sure.
I think it happens more to girls. But yeah, your uncle is not only, like, terribly successful and charming, but kind of hot, too. Go on.
He's a very fit man. He's in really good shape.
Yeah. Well, yeah, nice, so... Oh, and I've actually been to his house because
oh, yeah.
she was house-sitting.
That's a great house.
Yeah.
So, I have an uncle who is not Kevin Bacon.
Yes.
But he's a behind-the-scenes producer of television shows.
Yes.
And at that time, it was never like, oh, Uncle Scott in L.A. is going to give me a career.
Yeah.
Like, he was doing okay, but not too many, like, high-profile things.
Yeah.
But it was enough where it was like, okay, I can get you in the door. But
yeah.
You just gotta bust your butt.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did.
That's cool. I had relatives who were in the business, and they were like, sorry. Because I really wanted in. They were just like, yeah, no, can't help you.
Larry David, you could have got on Seinfeld.
I know. Larry, why didn't you help me? I do have a relative named Larry David. He's like my dad's second cousin. He sells used cars. And I tried to tell Larry David. I saw him at an event. I tried to share this funny anecdote with him. And I did share it with him. He was so uninterested that it could have been an episode.
I was at breakfast once with former After Party Chat guest Lewis Howes.
Oh, yes.
And okay. We saw Kevin Bacon at the restaurant where we were a few tables over. And he and I were both Kevin, that is, and yeah. I were both eating bacon at the same time, and it was like the greatest moment of my life.
But you didn't say something to him.
I didn't need to. I feel like we both, like, in our hearts. We knew. Yeah.
Wait, Lewis House. How do you know Lewis House? Through podcasting world. What a great guy.
Yeah,
for the first time this last week, I listened to Tony Robbins. I never had before. And I was like, Lewis House is the new Tony Robbins. I said that to him, and in fact, I've said that on this podcast, but I didn't really know for sure, because I never listened to Tony Robbins.
Yeah, it was in theory.
Yeah, but I think he's incredibly inspiring. In fact, I went on his webinar last week, and for 2 hours, I listened to how to build a webinar.
Yeah, he's good at that.
He's really good at that. Okay, so I got very sidetracked. Okay, here you are in Hollywood, making your way, but still a drunk.
Oh, it really took off when I got here.
Yeah.
Because, I had built some consequences, like, throughout college, and, like, fall asleep at the wheel after the stimulants wore off and narrowly got into a head-on collision.
What stimulants were you doing?
What I used to do was go to clubs in New York with some friends of mine and listen to whatever house or techno DJs we liked until the club would close at like 8 or 10 a.m. And then drive back to Albany, which is 2.5 hours. Not a good idea. So, but we did that a lot.
So what were you doing? What drugs? Ecstasy?
I think that night all I did was... I don't even think I did ecstasy that night. I mean, I did plenty of ecstasy, but I think that night it might have just been I was just like drinking and taking like prescription Ritalin or something like that. And then, like 6 p.m. the next night, I was driving by myself and just...
Oh, because you didn't sleep in between.
No.
Right.
Yeah, because I didn't sleep and because I'd exerted quite a bit of energy with driving 150 miles, being out in a club, drinking, and so I wasn't drunk or anything, but it had all wore off and I just passed out.
Right. That's a scary story. I remember once being so tired that I was like nodding off, and I was like, I should pull over and get coffee, and I didn't.
I didn't even realize it. I was like half a mile from my house.
Yeah. And you got in a collision.
I did not.
I
swerved across the other lane of traffic. And there was a hill. And I could have like rolled the car, but no. Then I was just like, oh, what the fuck? And then I slammed on the brakes on the other side of the road, and these cars stopped to be like, hey, are you okay? What's going on? And I was like so scared that I was gonna get in trouble, and so I just got in my car and sped away. Yeah.
Good Samaritans.
Yeah.
He's sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, thanks, guys, for checking on me.
And so then you are here, and the drinking is going off.
Oh, that's when I got really good.
Okay, yeah.
That's when I wasn't around friends or family, no accountability. I got to create a circle of new friends who partied the way I aspired to.
Yeah.
But all of a sudden, like, I'm living in Hollywood. I can, like, walk to bars, clubs, like, go to places I want to go, and it's way more fun than Albany, and the weather's better, and so that, it really took off. I mean, I was working on a lot of TV shows, like 12 hours a day, but I would still go out a lot.
And then what happened? Like, how did it all come crashing down?
Went great, Anna.
That's why you're here.
Yeah, it went great. It took 3.5 years of being in L.A., before my ass was kicked so bad that sobriety seemed like a good idea. And I was never someone who knew about sobriety. Like, I intellectually knew what it was, but I did not have any sober friends, or there was never, like, uncle.
And yet, you were working for a sober man.
I got to where I was working for great TV writer David Milch.
Who is open about it, so we're not outing anybody.
Yeah, no, he's open about it, and he's open about winning Emmys on heroin and things like that.
How long has he been sober? How long had he been sober when you were working for him?
I don't know. It's been a while.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
And so I remember this part of the story. So he said something to you.
Well, I had gotten to a point where, like, the party was over. and I did not know what the hell was wrong with my life. I was depressed. I was anxious. I did not like anyone I hung out with. The people who I actually liked didn't want to spend any time with me. Mm-hmm. Didn't have any money. I put everything on credit cards and a lot of like bar tabs that I didn't really remember how they got that high.
Right.
Because I was a big timer. I bought people drinks.
Yeah. Even though you didn't even like them.
No, it just seemed like a good idea.
But yet you had this job, but you were spending it all.
Well, I was a writer's assistant.
Yeah, then you don't get tons of money for that.
I was doing okay, but
you were living large, though.
I was living larger than I should have been.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I lived in a studio apartment, so it wasn't super large, but it was large enough that I didn't save anything and spend it all on stupid trips and alcohol and drugs and that sort of thing. But I got to a point where I just hated everything. I didn't know what the problem was. My stomach wasn't doing well, so I would drink and then like immediately get bloated and just hear it gurgle and feel weird.
Okay, no, too much for me.
That's all. That's all I'm gonna say.
Okay.
And I was just like questioning life, like, How do things? Why do things feel this bad? Like, why? How do things get this way?
Right.
And then, alcohol was supposed to fix it, and it just wasn't helping anymore.
Yeah.
Like I would drink, and I would just get like a headache and bloated.
Yeah.
Like, it wouldn't let me like feel good.
Do you believe that it's sort of the brain chemistry, body chemistry, or whatever? You get to a certain point where alcohol and drugs sort of turn on you. You've maxed out. Everybody's place is different.
I think so, but also I'm a wuss. Like, I drank with people and used with people who hit it harder than I did. Mm-hmm. It just affected me different. And it took me down where maybe they're still drinking.
When you say took you down and affected you differently, what do you mean?
For example, like my stomach.
Okay.
Like, my stomach was rejecting the way I like to drink.
Right.
And that did not happen to everybody else, even if they drank more.
What about the obsession? Were you obsessed with it?
Yeah. I could go to work without drinking, but I was always like hungover. Maybe take a pill of something here or there,
mm-hmm.
or I was just fixating all day on like, hey, who wants to go to happy hour after work or whatever it was. Like,
I just hated happy hour, by the way.
I did too, but it was like a good way for me to. Like you know how when you were like going liquor shopping, you kind of felt good. You ever get that?
I was a Coke person. I mean, I drink beer weirdly.
Well, you know how you're going to the dealer.
And you start feeling good. The anticipation, euphoric anticipation.
Yeah, I would have that talking about happy hour.
Oh yeah, okay.
So I didn't actually like happy hour.
Yeah.
But it was a way to spend the day not in the moment.
I'm so glad you brought that up.
Yeah, and in the next drink.
I'm glad you brought this up because I think about this. I feel that euphoric anticipation and euphoric recall were actually more fun than at first, like in high school and college, than the actual partying.
Because it's perfect.
Absolutely, it's all fantasy and you know, reflection.
We're fantasy-driven people.
Yes,
I find.
Yes, I find that to be true as well. So,
but I got to a point where I tried to drink and use to where the goal was to hurt myself.
What do you mean?
A half-assed suicide attempt.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you mean? What did you do?
I drank and I used a lot of. I had like all these different drugs that didn't really go well together.
Like what?
Special K.
Ugh, I hate that.
Yeah, I was a big fan of that. I got to be a bit of a specialist.
I went into a K hole. I accidentally did it thinking it was Coke and had a party.
I read that in your book.
Oh yeah. You know what? In the book, it's a little embellished because I didn't go to the hospital. But yeah, go buy Party Girl if you're listening.
But when I read Party Girl, I like started cheering. At that part, like,
oh, because you're like Special K.
Shout out to Special K. So I think it was like K, ecstasy, coke, weed, maybe more. I don't
recall.
You mixed
those things.
Yeah.
Okay.
As much as I could with a lot of alcohol to try and hurt myself.
But so you were very depressed, let's assume.
Yeah, I was very depressed.
And were you on any antidepressants? Were you trying to treat it? You didn't go to therapy?
Nothing.
Okay.
No. And I had punched a bus stop.
Okay.
Because I just couldn't control, like, my emotions.
Okay.
And so I was, like, walking home from a bar. And I just was so frustrated with life. I just punched this bus stop.
Okay.
And my hand immediately, like, crumbled.
Okay.
And as a writer's assistant who had to type, I was like, oh, well, I'm going to be out of a job now. And that was, like, the only thing I really felt like I had going for me.
Yeah.
And so, at that moment, it was just, I was like, all right, let's hurt yourself, buddy.
That night of the punching of the bus stop?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Because it was plastic, and it busted your, like, you got blood?
Yeah, it was, like, hard plastic.
Did you go to the hospital?
Not immediately, like, 2 days later.
Oh, God.
But my hand swelled up, like,
oh.
It was like a Thanksgiving turkey.
Oh, God, that's disgusting.
Yeah.
And so, in those 2 days, is that when you... before you went to the hospital, that you said, this, fuck this, I'm ending it.
Yeah, yeah. And then they sent a co-worker to come find me.
Because you were passed out.
Yeah, and I was, like, naked on my apartment floor. It looked like a crime scene.
Well, why was there blood everywhere?
Well, not a crime scene. That kind of crime scene.
Like, somebody had been...
just sketchy.
Right.
You know, just bottles everywhere and garbage and...
Right.
Drug stuff.
Right. And... so, the coworker came and got you. They didn't know why. They were just like, where is he?
Yeah.
And he discovered this.
Yeah. And then I went to some really crappy doctor's office,
mm-hmm.
who had, like, an x-ray tech there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm like, oh, maybe I won't have to go to the hospital. And then I, like, waited around all day and didn't get an x-ray. And then I tried to go to work, mm-hmm. the next day, on the day that... October 10th, 2007,
mm-hmm.
which would be my first day of sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time, like, I had a conversation about my drinking that was not somebody yelling at me.
Mm-hmm.
It was me trying to lie to my boss,
mm-hmm.
and him saying, this is all bullshit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And me saying, yeah. But I did not plan on that. Mm-hmm. It's just what came out of my mouth.
Had people yelled at you about your drinking before? Like,
yeah.
Girlfriends?
Yeah. Or people have just kind of yelled at me in general.
Mm-hmm.
Like stop screwing around, or pay attention, or, you know, you're a different person when you drink, mm-hmm. so how about you don't drink so much, or...
Well, because when you said you punched a bus stop, you would strike me as, like, one of the least angry people I've ever encountered.
Thank you.
So
I think so, too.
Yeah. So I think it's, so that was your, that's what drinking brought out in you?
Yeah. Ever? Oh, I got angry. Like, especially in my last year of drinking. Like, I was seeing this girl, and we would just, like, yell at each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it was no, like, violence.
Right.
But I had never had a relationship where, like, I was a yeller.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that's just where I was, mm-hmm. at that time. And it sucked, and I hated it.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know how to change anything.
Mm-hmm.
Until my boss said, maybe you might want to look at your drinking issue.
And so did you go to a meeting that day?
No, I went to the hospital,
mm-hmm.
after that to get some real x-rays,
mm-hmm.
and take care of my hand.
Mm-hmm. And then?
And then I kind of detoxed in my bed,
mm-hmm.
by myself for like 2 days. Just
like sweating.
Just sweating and gross and... just, like, praying my butt off.
Had you prayed before?
Not really.
So what were you... How did you... You were just like, I can't deal. God, help me.
Yeah. Yeah, I was like, I need help.
Yeah.
And what happened after admitting to my boss that I had a problem,
mm-hmm.
was I felt like the jig was up.
Right.
Like, this life that at some point turned into, like, a false life,
mm-hmm.
was over. Like, I had a chance to, like, find out who I was, or, like, go back to the guy who I used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, I didn't know how to do that, but I was open to suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
And because I related to his story, and, you know, I trusted him, and he's like, you know, why don't you go check out the rooms?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I did. And I didn't go to rehab, mm-hmm. but because I was working in a place where I had to be accountable for my sobriety, because we'd worked pretty much 6 days a week, I would be at work all day and then go be with sober people at night. And that was my life for a long time, but especially at the beginning, it was almost like I had like the same structure they give you at a sober living mm-hmm. or something, or like outpatient, mm-hmm. except then I would go home to my former drug den.
Right.
Which I threw away a lot of crap.
Yeah, yeah. So you go to your first meeting. How did you even find your first meeting?
The internet.
Okay, so you look online. Like most people, I'm assuming, going, this is not what I want to be doing right now. Fuck this. But I'm going to do it anyway.
If he had given me some other, like, option of, like, here's a way to take care of yourself, I would have done that.
Right.
And so I was kind of on autopilot a little bit. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'll fire you if I have to, but I'll give you a chance to get it together. So I was open to that. Mm-hmm. I was like, all right, yeah. And so it wasn't a way to keep my job. It occurred to me in that moment that maybe I should live. Mm-hmm. And maybe if I drank, I'd kill myself either by accidentally or on purpose. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I was afraid. It was mm-hmm. like good motivation.
Yeah. Yeah. I relate to that. So you go to your first meeting, which we don't need to get specific, but were you just like immediately like, I'm Caleb and I'm an alcoholic?
No. I was not ready to say to anyone that mm-hmm. I was an alcoholic. Because mm-hmm. I was like, well, I drink too much. Mm-hmm. But I have other issues too. Mm-hmm. Like I eat too many carbs. Mm-hmm. I'm depressed. Like I felt like there was a lot of issues. And I was like, maybe my issue is not alcoholism. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's that I drink because of something else. Like mm-hmm. you know, trying to find a way out of not having to put that label on me. Mm-hmm. And then after meeting other people in recovery and hearing different things, I was like, oh, I just didn't know what alcoholism was.
Right.
Like a lot of people, I was like, oh, I just thought you had to be the guy in the street corner with the brown paper bag. Mm-hmm. You know, I had been that guy on occasion. Like, not homeless, but would have like a
paper bag.
Like a flask or something.
Yeah.
At like a weird place where people are like, why are you drinking?
But that is interesting that you had that perception given the fact that your very successful boss was sober.
Yeah, but he was also a guy who used needles.
Right, so it seemed different, yeah.
So in my head, I was like, yeah, well, that guy had a crazy story.
Yeah, yeah. So, but you met people because there you were hanging out with them at night. So you befriended people.
Yeah, really quickly. Mm-hmm. And especially men.
Mm-hmm.
And, good. And that was exactly what I needed.
You know, do guys have those, like, friendships and they're like, oh my God, you're so my new sober friend. And then you realize they're nuts.
Yeah.
It's different.
Yeah, but it's not with that same passion.
Yeah.
Like that you just have in your voice talking.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God, you're my new best friend. Yeah. We don't say it like that. It's like, we should, like, hang out. Do stuff.
And so you started doing that, and you were working as Milch's assistant. That's not an easy thing to say. Sorry. Milch's. Doesn't sound right. And you were writing for LAist.
Well, I was about a year sober, mm-hmm. and I had done a lot in recovery, and I had really turned things around. I had went back to New York, and we shot a pilot there,
mm-hmm.
and so I was in New York for almost 2 months for summer, and that was like the biggest trial of my sobriety, because I had to like take all these tools and things that I had learned, and then apply them in a place where I had been especially crazy.
Yeah.
And it worked. Mm-hmm. And it was shortly after that when I got back to LA where I was like, I think I can like do stuff with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And as someone who wanted to be a television writer, who was a writer's assistant, and this happens to a lot of people who become writer's assistants, like it's hard to go home and write a script at night because you're in scripts all day long. And mm-hmm. it's like it takes so much discipline, and the brain just kind of rebels against mm-hmm. it, almost. So that's when I was like, how about I try and find some other forms of writing or creative outlets?
Mm-hmm.
So it was in that like 2 year period where I did some like sketch comedy stuff, some improv, podcasting, sports writing.
Oh, but so did you go to UCB and take classes?
Yeah, I took some classes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like this great kind of sober experience where it's like, I didn't know I could do all this stuff.
Yeah.
Like I had time, mm-hmm. but I was also open to living my life
mm-hmm.
and not just being in bars and clubs and in that whole thing, which I thought was the greatest thing ever at one point.
Yeah.
But no more.
And you became, I wouldn't say obsessive, but you became like really interested in like Dr. Drew and Jen Jimenez. I didn't mean to call it obsessive, but that was like a passion of yours and that whole the sober media.
Yeah.
Recovery media or whatever.
Well, I had been a Loveline fan for a long time.
Okay.
And so then when I got sober, that's when Celebrity Rehab came out,
mm-hmm.
that same fall.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to like watch people on television having a similar experience when I was new in recovery, and that really resonated with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had I think this was a lot ego, but I was like, you know, I bet if I interviewed people who I think are cool, we could become friends.
Right, and, right. I do that all the time.
Yeah, and so that was like a way to do work I thought was interesting, but also a ticket into something more.
Did you want to be my friend?
I did.
It worked.
Here we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm helping you with your audio.
I mean, we're friends.
The first time I heard you on Dr. Drew's radio show, I was like, I don't know who Anna David is, but she is cool.
Awesome. That's all I ever want to hear. Because you heard it on that AM show. Because
yeah.
I've barely been on Loveline.
Yeah, short-lived AM show.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
That was, I mean, it was cool because I got to go to the set of Celebrity Rehab to do it. And then he's like, you want to see the set? And we walk in and he introduced me. This is my friend, Anna David. And I was like, oh my God, he called me his friend.
Yeah.
So you just had dinner with him and his lovely wife, Susan.
I did, yeah.
How did that come about?
Just because we're BFFs.
Yeah,
you know?
Why not?
I'll answer that in a second. But
okay. For
anyone who's read the AA book,
mm-hmm.
So the preface, it was written by Dr. Silkworth.
Yes.
Who was a medical non-alcoholic.
Yes.
Like professional in that field at the time. And I think I remember you referring to Dr. Drew as like, yeah,
the Dr. Silkworth of today, the modern day.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was so cool. But to have anyone who's not from the world of recovery as an alcoholic or addict,
yeah,
to trumpet the horn
mm-hmm.
of 12-step recovery,
yeah,
I think is the greatest thing.
I know. I totally agree. It is because I always think you can't get it unless you're an alcoholic or you know, you need to go through it. And even our lovely parents who try so hard really can't get it. And loving friends, I have a couple friends who I actually think do get it, but that he seems to understand it so well. I mean, like he's worked in the field for a long time.
Other people have too.
And yeah.
Maybe they don't get it as
yeah.
well as he does.
Yeah. I mean, I've talked to him about that. I mean, just about how sad it is that medical schools, you know, don't focus on it at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, that I went to many doctors I went to a psychiatrist who is a quote unquote specialist now. He either owns or is on staff at an eating disorder clinic here in LA. And I went to him, told him I did coke. He made me go tell my other therapist, which I was not legal, I didn't know that, and then said to me, I was getting a lot of Ambien off of him and lying all the time,
yeah.
And he gave me enough Ambien to kill myself, cut off my antidepressants, and said, I can't see you anymore. I think you know why. Never said rehab, never said AA. That's what a quote-unquote addiction specialist
Jeez.
Did.
Well, good times.
Good times,
yeah.
Real fun. And so, okay, and so you, dream come true, you get to meet Dr. Drew, you get to do all of this stuff, and you were really somebody who was trying to let the world know about what this was like, and nobody, lots of sober people are writers, and they weren't out there doing that.
Well, I thought it was cool just being in LA, like, not so much like the celebrities you bump into in different recovery spaces, but there's just so many interesting people doing cool things in the
yeah.
world. And so I thought as a way of doing different types of journalism, like I could could spotlight some of those people.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really fun thing for me to do for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout that time, like, I interviewed some people and started doing podcasts with, like, people who are in the Dr. Drew world.
Mm-hmm.
So I met him a few times here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But then his wife has a podcast.
I know. About astrology, right?
About psychics.
About psychics, yeah.
Yeah, I had two psychic readings.
On her show?
On her show. And that's he amazing. Co-hosted with her.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and they invited me out to dinner afterwards.
That is so cute.
It was me, the Dr. Drew's wife, and a psychic at dinner.
Did you learn a lot about yourself?
It was freaky. Like, I had never had a psychic reading before. Mm-hmm. But there's two psychics.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one was talking about stuff that related to my life in a way that if she had heard my phone calls with friends, like, she could have picked up on stuff.
Oh, my God.
And I don't think she did pick up on... I don't think she's tapping my phones.
Right.
But it was...
Could be like a Rupert Murdoch scandal. That's her secret.
That's the secret?
I have a great tarot card reader that I know. I should try to get her on that podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
She's cool. Amazing. She's sober.
The podcast is called Calling Out with Susan Pinsky.
That's amazing.
And it's funny because Susan's way into the psychic thing.
Yeah.
And has been for a while. And Dr. Drew is the man of science
yeah.
that we all know.
Yeah.
And he still finds it really interesting.
Yeah.
And he was trying to explain to me, like, scientifically what he thinks goes on.
Yeah.
And it was a very cool experience.
Yeah. I'm going on his podcast next week, actually.
Oh, great.
I mean, listeners, this is all out of order because I have no idea of the order when this is all airing. But I'm going with Mike Carano, speaking
oh, cool.
of friends of Dr. Drew's show.
Yeah.
Who's a fascinating guy. I met him because he came on this podcast.
Drew loves Mike.
Yeah, but they truly are BFFs and go to Disneyland together and, like, all the time.
I don't get the Disneyland thing.
No,
for anyone.
I know, I don't get it either. I'm so glad you said that.
What
are people so into about that as adults?
Like, for people who live here, everyone knows someone who has, like, a season pass.
Or what about that restaurant that people are so into?
Oh, yeah. Club 33? Like, no, seriously, guys, it's the best restaurant.
Why would I want to go to a restaurant at Disneyland? But it is the hardest to get into restaurant in Los Angeles, apparently.
But it's not in Los Angeles, it's in Anaheim.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So you have to get there and then park 5 miles away for $25.
Yeah, not down.
I don't get it.
Let's not go to Disneyland together one day.
That'd be awesome.
So your podcast, I want to talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
You interview men about, like, inspiring men?
Yeah, real life experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So what had helped me the most and continues to help me the most throughout sobriety is not always the direct guidance, but just the good, honest conversations about real issues with other guys. And if somebody's telling me about something that's not related to my own experience, I still find a lot I can take away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just encourages me to be transparent and not be a jerk and be spiritual and all this stuff. And so I thought there was some real magic there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to make a podcast out of it. And so it's one-on-one conversations where sometimes it'll be someone talking about something kind of ordinary, like being a single dad or...
Mm-hmm.
as outrageous as being kidnapped or cancer or sobriety or things like that.
You're James Elroy. I guess you've had him on twice,
yeah.
right? I only heard the first one.
First
Holy
one's the best one.
Shit,
yeah.
Was that good.
Thank
I just, like, how do you know him? Is it through Milch? I wondered.
No. We have some mutual friends.
Uh-huh.
And we... And we just hit it off.
Yeah.
And we... like, go out to eat once a week, and...
So it's like Carano and Drew, you and Elroy.
Yeah, we went to a soul food restaurant in South Central on Saturday night.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was really cool.
I met him once, and he was so not interested in being my best friend. I would say it was a little bit like meeting Larry David, in terms of the enthusiasm on his part.
Okay.
Fine. And yet he's very into the ladies, as I heard on your podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Which he talked extensively about. Yeah, so good.
Yeah, that was one of my... And that's also an interesting thing, because having a podcast, like, I don't always want to ask everyone to do it, because my instinct is to ask everyone to do it.
Yeah.
That with him, I had to explain to him what a podcast was.
It's the only one he's ever done.
Yeah, like, he's appeared on radio that they've archived a podcast and things like that, but yeah, that was, and I think still is, the only actual podcast.
Because it was
podcast. Fairly
recently.
Yeah.
Yeah, your podcast is great, and we've had some crossover.
Yeah.
Who have we both had?
Lewis Howes, Alonzo Bowden.
Uh-huh. I want you to get Greg Barron, who's the best ever. He's been traveling so much.
I know. He and I have meant to do a podcast for years.
Yeah. And so right now you're writing on Sullivan and Son, so you became a real writer, not a writer's assistant.
Yeah, it all happened. Like, mm-hmm. And it was so much about stuff I'd learned in recovery. And then, sure, I got better because I wasn't drinking and using, but I also grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still growing up. But I got to, like, learn the concept of trying to put off short-term, like, feeling good in the short term so I could feel good in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like, okay, I'm going to write this article. And then when it finally goes out and people see it, I'll be happy. But while I'm writing it, I'm not going to feel as good. I just have to get to that point.
Right.
Where it can get out.
And, but so in terms of like writing the pilot that you had to write, the writing samples that you had to do.
Yeah.
And I'm writing a pilot right now. I'm outlining it. It's fucking hard.
It's so hard.
And just even getting the form, whatever. I admire it a lot because I don't know that I can do it. We'll see.
It's hard.
Yeah.
I mean, you can do it. You're an excellent writer.
I thank you. I have tried repeatedly. Never, like, right now I'm taking a class. I mean, the class is almost over, and I've never actually had the humility to do that because I'm an asshole and I'm like, a writing class. Are you kidding me? I teach writing classes. But so I've gone in not knowing what I'm doing, and then it hasn't gone very far.
Right. You get tired of it, and you're like, screw this.
Well, yeah, nobody responded.
I'll go write another best-selling book.
Yeah, please. I'm never doing that again. You're not delusional enough to think you want to write a book, are you?
Only with Tom Sizemore.
God.
Don't
do it.
Like, I never... I don't know if it's like a low self-esteem thing or just...
How about it's a high self-esteem thing?
Well, no. For me, I never really thought I could do much.
Yeah.
But it was also because I just didn't really think about my future.
Yeah.
Like, when people say, like, what do you want to do? And you grow up, I was like, I don't know, something fun.
Yeah.
Like, I just didn't have a sense of, like, where I was going to fit in the world. And so it's only been, like, recently where I'm like, I could write a book. I don't know if I want to, but it just never occurred to me that I could.
I so relate to that. And I do think that has to do with being an addict, that I had no idea what I wanted to do. And again, I pictured myself being sort of glamorous in like a suit, which is interesting because I've never owned one, and in an office and wearing heels and, like, you know, maybe ordering some people around. But I had no idea beyond that what it would be.
That's it.
Yeah.
That was me, except that no heels.
And so, for me, writing a book, it completely was a one-day-at-a-time thing. You know, I was like, I want to write a book, and then I'm like, I can't write a book, and then I realized, I could write one day at a time. And, you know, if you write 3 pages a day, I'm no mathematician, but in less than a year, you have a book.
Sure.
But don't do it, is all I can say. If I can help anybody in this world forget what I have to say about recovery, let me tell you about recovery from trying to write books as for a living.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
It's working out for my friend James Elroy.
Okay, yeah, it's true. You know, when you're talking about talent at that level...
A little different.
Yeah. And I was just seeing that today. I'm going off on a tiny tangent, but about how everybody gets bad when they get successful, that it's impossible not to lose that somehow. And that's why I'm so obsessed with Beyonce and Jay-Z, because they get better every year. I'm like, how do you not lose touch with what made you so good when the accolades that come along with success make you forget how to access that? And I was thinking that it's only true, like, writers like Philip Roth, and Elroy is a good example, when they seem really fucking tortured. The torture, I have never met Elroy. I've barely read Elroy. But that is the torture keeps you in touch. And with Jay-Z and Beyonce, they don't seem tortured at all. that's why it's so fascinating to me.
Yeah, yeah, they're definitely different.
Yeah.
What's something that I've noticed about some really successful writers that I've worked with in television is, this is sort of a tangent off your tangent.
Yeah,
but,
go ahead.
But they're able to separate their sense of self from the materials.
Uh-huh.
Like, when we're working on a script, it's not my script or our script, it's the script.
Right.
Like, the script is not me. And that is, like, such, like, the perfect way to be, I think, for an alcoholic,
mm-hmm.
about a creative work.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, the project's the project. I'm just the one doing it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that would be very challenging.
It's the hardest thing ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been slightly panic attacking this whole time that somehow this didn't record after all of our recording experiences, and I'm not just saying this. This has been one of the best conversations I've had on this podcast.
Wow, thank you.
Do you feel good about it?
I feel good, yeah.
Okay. Well, I didn't mean to do that abrupt sign-off, but we really should end.
Because the sound is going to cut out?
Because we've been talking a long time, and because, you know, why all good things must come to an end is the cliche, and the cliche exists because it's true.
True. And the moral of the story is, if you get sober, you can work in a sitcom bar.
You can.
Like I do.
I'm jealous, but I feel less jealous because of hearing how industrious you were this whole time. Sorry, weird note to end on. Let's talk about recovery.
Stay sober.
How long are you sober?
It will be 7 years, October the 10th.
Nice. Okay. Yeah.
So that was Caleb Bacon here on After Party Pod. Podcaster, writer, go-getter. I hope you loved him. I think you did. Go check out his podcast, Man School. And don't forget about Audible. Go to audibletrial.com/afterpartypod to support the show and get a free download. Yeah, and go review us on iTunes, because I'll love you forever. Thank you.